Hi, welcome to the show. I'm here with Anne from Autistics for Autistics Ontario. And would you be able to describe the history of your organization and your work with it?
Yes, it's great to be here too. Thanks for inviting me. Our organization was founded in November of 2017, and it was co-founded. I'm one of the co-founders, as a way for autistic people to be able to speak for ourselves. So it's an autistic self-advocacy organization. We do work in community education, political advocacy, and community support and community building.
And you recently wrote a plain language guide on COVID-19. Would you mind describing the contents of it?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I have it right in front of me. We came up with this idea, a couple of us in the group, to get something out there about COVID-19 that's in plain language, meaning that more people can understand it. It's not full of a lot of technical jargon. And also specifically for autistic people, talking about some of the things that we would specifically be concerned about. So it starts out with talking about what COVID-19 is, explains why we're sheltering in place or staying at home, as we are here in Ontario. And then it gives some resources for people who use AAC, which is alternative communication devices, people who are non-speaking, give some resources for people who are non-speaking for navigating the medical system and what's going on and having access to communication. And then it talks a little bit about kind of coping and how to connect with people, how to cope with what's going on, with a little bit of advice as well for caregivers, if someone is living with a caregiver, and then a brief discussion about what might happen next, because that was a really big question that a lot of people have.
Could you describe why plain language is necessary in communications for COVID-19 and others?
It's really, really important, and we don't see very much of it. I'm really surprised with COVID how little communication is coming out of the medical field that can be understood by the average person. A lot of it's really technical, and you start looking at all these big words and long paragraphs, and it feels very overwhelming, and it's hard to understand. So it's really, really important, especially in the case of something where it's about health and safety, to make sure that it's plain language. The challenge with plain language is that sometimes plain language guides, if they're not written by actually disabled people, they can come across as kind of patronizing, right? And kind of like talking down to the person. So the best people to write plain language guides are people who are autistic, have Down syndrome, a variety of intellectual disabilities, really driving these projects, writing these projects, or at the very least, very heavily consulting and very heavily involved with these kind of guides so that they really speak to people in a way that is comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any other plain language guides that have been circulating? And how does yours differ from those that have already been created?
Yeah, there are some good ones. I will say Harvard did plain language, but then they kind of messed it up because they had it like by age group, like for 5 to 7-year-olds. Like that doesn't really work. You know, cognition isn't kind of broken down like grades in school. However, Brandeis did a really nice one, and that could be read by people of any age, Brandeis University. Another great one was written by the Green Mountain Self-Advocates, and that was actually written by people who are disabled, have intellectual or developmental disability. So that was written in a really, really accessible way. And then there's Our Guide, and these are the major ones. There are also some good guides by AAC makers. Cough Drop, I think, has a guide. And there's another guide by Assistive Wear. Assistive Wear has been doing a lot of good guides and information for people who are using AAC to communicate.
And do you believe that the methods that the government has used thus far to communicate vital information regarding COVID-19 has been sufficient?
I think they could do a better job with plain language, especially by consulting with people who understand plain language and know how to write using plain language and benefit from plain language. I think for sure they could be doing a better job.
So governmental briefings on coronavirus only recently began offering accessibility measures, for example, sign language interpretation, the week of March 16th. Why do you think the implementation of methods of communication such as this were considered later in comparison to quote-unquote traditional communication?
I think it's that way so much of the time that disabled people are an afterthought. And I don't know why. I mean, especially federally, because they've made this big statement about how they're going to start, what's the expression that they use, like including disability in everything they do, like right from the start. So it was actually, I was surprised at how long it took them because I knew that they had this new commitment, but I haven't really seen a lot of legs to that commitment, and that was really disappointing. And I think there still is more work to be done to reach various disabled communities in the way they communicate.
The Accessible Canada Act, in its current status, primarily refers to federal physical, like governmental bodies, so for example, government buildings. Do you feel that language should have been included in the creation of this act?
It really, really should have. And like any disability accommodation, it will benefit everyone, not just disabled people, if they had included language in that. The legislation also really didn't have anything for autistic people. And there was no consultation done with autistic people for that legislation. So there are a number of things missing there.
Are there methods of communication that the government hasn't yet implemented that would be able to better assist disabled people?
I think so. I think that they need to communicate more directly with disability self-advocacy groups and disability self-advocates and ask, what are different communities and individuals need, and then respond to that need. I don't think having a bunch of quote unquote experts who are non-disabled trying to just kind of do guesswork on the fly in the background as an afterthought is going to be a good way to do it. We'd like to see the government really reaching out directly to groups like ours and asking us what's missing and what we need. And we can provide it. I mean, it's very simple for us to do that rather than having them kind of doing guesswork.
And do you feel that the accessibility measures regarding language have been adequately communicated by caregivers to the populations that require them? For example, in the blog post, you mentioned that there are soundboards specific to COVID-19. Is this a feature that's widely known to caregivers as a resource?
I mean, I think the companies that make these boards are trying to get the information out there, but I don't think that it's entirely successful. I think if someone, it all depends on the quality of who's caring for the person and where the person lives. If they're living in a residential program where the people are really not putting effort into knowing what's new and knowing what's going on and querying these things, I don't think they're going to find them. You know, you would really need something. This is all happening kind of ad hoc by private groups, groups like ours. In the case of AAC, it might be a company that's making AAC, but if you don't use that brand, you might never hear about it. Ideally, you would have kind of a master post, a master list that the government had of accessibility resources, and then they would distribute these resources to all of the residential programs and all of the schools in terms of how they're doing education, the way that they're doing education now. And they would have a way to get it to parents as well through various agencies. But that's not happening.
And why do you feel it isn't happening?
I don't think they have had a plan. I don't know. I mean, I'm just speculating at this point, but it doesn't look like they had thought about these various moving pieces when they were getting ready for something like a pandemic. So they need to reach out and ask people in the disability community. And I mean, really disabled people. In the case of autistic people, there is a whole bunch of non-autistic people who claim to speak for us, groups like CASDA and some of these other Autism Speaks. If the government's going and asking them, they're going to the wrong people. Those people are not disabled, and they don't know what it's like to be autistic, and they don't know what autistic people need. They need to reach out directly to self-advocates to understand what's needed.
How does the level of recommendations vary when provided by someone such as a representative from Autism Speaks who necessarily doesn't have autism versus directly from a person with autism?
Well, we're asking everyone in the broader disability community not to partner with or work with organizations like Autism Speaks or CASDA in particular, because they are, first of all, in the case of Autism Speaks, there's the broader issue of the genetic research and some of the eugenics that they support. But aside from that, they also really follow what's known as the medical model of disability, where the disabled person is the problem and you fix the child to make them fit in a world that isn't built for them. The social model of disability tells us, why don't we make some changes to the world around us so that it can fit us? And it's the same for autism as it is for any disability, right? And I think that these big groups that kind of speak, they tend to speak as though we're broken puzzle pieces that need to be fixed, and what kind of therapies and things can we get so that we're not so weird and whatever, is really damaging to autistic people in many, many ways. And it doesn't make for successful outcomes either. If the government and policymakers are looking for successful outcomes, the only way you're going to have that is if we look at autism from the social model of disability and start making changes to the environment. And the only people that can really communicate what changes are needed, whether it's in school, whether it's in healthcare, or anywhere else, the only people who are really going to be able to articulate what's needed is actually autistic people. Like, for example, we go, Autistics for Autistics, our group, goes to the University of Toronto Medical School a couple of times a year, and we give a talk about to med students, how can you make your practice accessible for people who use AAC, for people with sensory issues, for people with communication differences, all of the types of challenges that we know that we have faced when we have tried to seek healthcare. We know what the barriers are that we face, and we know that there are some really simple solutions. And when we go in and speak to the med students about how they can make their practice more accessible, they're very receptive. They're very open. It's really a simple matter of teaching them some really simple accessibility measures that will have an impact on hundreds of people throughout their career. But we're the only ones doing it. It's the autistic people that are doing it. When you have an autism organization like Autism Speaks or someone coming in, they're much more likely to talk about how to identify autism or kind of make us seem like we're like sort of a germ in a petri dish rather than, hey, we're people. And it would really help if you learned a little bit about this. It would really help if you could allow your patients to email if they are not able to use the phone, things like that. And that all comes from the grassroots, the disability rights community, not from these big organizations who claim to speak for us.
And have these organizations, for example, spoken or released anything in regards to COVID-19? And what are your thoughts on those?
I've been looking. Now, I haven't seen anything from Autism Speaks. I kind of don't like looking at what they do. Yeah. Because of the eugenics, et cetera. But I have seen some organizations that have put out guides. Generally, they're putting out like a guide for caregivers. And then it'll be this like massive long document of like how to talk to your child about COVID. Already they've taken the subjectivity away from the actually autistic person. They're not addressing autistic people. They're addressing their carers, and that just symbolic of how they tend to do things. And I just saw one today. I couldn't believe it. Someone sent it to me. I can't remember who put it out. It was a Canadian group from the West. And they did this whole big thing, this whole big website. They probably had grant money for it. And they never once mentioned non-speaking, non-verbal autistic people. They had it all set up for autistic people who could speak, but we know that like 30% of autistic people are either non-speaking or partially speaking. It's quite incredible that a big agency like that would just render all those people invisible in their document.
And how has the community in Ontario been impacted by the crisis?
I think it's been impacted depending on where you live and who you are. So for some people who are living on their own or with roommates out on their own, they are facing, in many, many cases, because poverty is a big problem in our community, facing a lot of economic insecurity and a lot of worry about what might happen to their job, a lot of worry about what's going to happen with Ontario Works or ODSP or some of the programs that people are receiving. So there is anxiety and uncertainty and fear around the economic part of it. Then there's the social isolation, which everyone has to deal with, but which feels a little bit different maybe for an autistic person than it would for a neurotypical person. I don't want to generalize to all autistic people. I think there are some stereotypes out there that we all just want to sit home and pet our cat and we don't really care that we have to stay home. And we're all introverts, and that's not really true. Like, a lot of autistic people are really extroverted. And I think anyone, whether you're autistic or not, is missing the community, missing the routine. But I think from a sensory perspective, it can be more difficult, being inside than it might be for someone else. It can be particularly difficult for people who are living in a group home setting or, in a family setting where they're not happy and not comfortable, or that's not welcoming for them. I really, really worry about people in those kind of situations where there may have been an opportunity to get out for work and get out for school, and now they're home. So there's that as well. And then there's the sense of not knowing what's coming, which is something that impacts everyone. But it can be especially frustrating, and can really start to lead you down a path of reading and learning and understanding and getting super duper into understanding COVID to the point where it's like, oh, you know, okay, I've learned everything possible about COVID now. I need to find ways to decompress. I need to find ways to connect with other people. So I guess to summarize, there's economic concerns. There are stress concerns of depending on people's living situations. And then there are our sensory and coping concerns that do look and feel different than they do for a lot of neurotypical people.
And how is the government of Ontario dealing with this crisis?
I'm just giving my opinion as an individual. I was really surprised. I watched Ford yesterday giving a press conference, and he was kind of being baited by the right-wing media to make negative comments about Trudeau and by a certain reporter, and he deflected it and he praised Trudeau. And I was really happy to see that. Like, it does seem like the government is taking its direction from public health experts, whether they're federal or whether they're provincial. So that was really comforting for me. The fallout once this is all over, I don't know. Like, I don't really know economically and socially what kind of impact it's going to have on our community, because so many in our community are already living at very low income and living on ODSP. That conversation isn't really happening right now, so it's really hard to tell, because it is a Tory government, what that's really going to be like in the future in terms of funding and aid.
And what are your opinions on the fact that the majority of disability support plans across Canada are below the poverty line, but with the bill that has been proposed, individuals would be receiving almost twice as much, for example, as recipients of ODSP. How do you feel that proposal impacts the level that we've set for essentially putting disabled people in poverty for no reason?
Well, it certainly points out the existing system, that the way that it isn't fair and the way that people are constantly living on the poverty line, and people who want to work a little bit get penalized for that. People who want to live with their partner or get married obviously are penalized right now under that system. This, for us as activists, it's an opportunity for us to raise awareness and say, well, compare the aid that's being provided by the government to what we're getting. It's a good opportunity to make people aware of the discrepancies and the second-class citizenship that comes from those discrepancies.
How can non-disabled people be allies to disabled people during this pandemic?
I think non-disabled people can be allies for disabled people by giving us a place at the podium. I think it's really, really important in any kind of project that has to do with COVID at all that disabled people are right there, front and center, because we're in a place right now where we have space in Ontario for everyone in the hospital. But as we know, down in the U.S., they're rationing care. And as we know, sometimes the rationing programs exclude people that are disabled and are discriminatory towards people that are disabled. And there's a lot of worry and concern in Canada that could happen here, depending on the direction that things go with healthcare and this virus. So some guarantees and some real commitment to making sure that disabled people are not left out in those kind of scenarios, and that evaluation of our life and an affirmation that our lives have value is really, really important. And visibility for autistic people and all disabled people, as much visibility as possible as well, is really, really important right now. My concern is that disabled people will not be given life-saving medical care in the event that there is rationing, and that it could be built into the triage policies at hospitals. And I think what everyone would like to see now is a really ironclad guarantee of that. And as well, just in general, positivity about disabled people coming from our government as a way to reassure people that it's not going to happen here the way that it has been happening in the U.S.
If listeners wanted more information on your organization, what should they do?
Oh, yes. So we're on Twitter. Our Twitter is at A4A Ontario. So A number 4A Ontario. And we're also on Facebook, A4A public page, it's called. We also have a website, which is a4aontario.com. And that's where you can find the plain language COVID guide with pictures. And we're also going to have more plain language COVID guides, as well as kind of survival guides for dealing with sheltering in place, and lots of other resources that we're putting together, including a master list of AAC resources. So definitely check it out. So many things that we had going are kind of on hold. We just heard today, and it wasn't a big surprise, but we heard that our neurodiversity flag raising at Toronto City Hall that was supposed to happen on April 6th, of course, has been canceled. So on April 6th, we're kind of taking a page from Fridays for Future, and we're going to make our neurodiversity flag raising go online and do kind of a virtual one. And then we're also doing some work with Arch Disability Law Center on a number of projects. And we have our outreach program for medical school education. We have a employment education project going on. And you can read more about our projects if you go onto our blog and look at our quarterly reports to kind of see ongoing projects. The last project I want to mention is our Little Neurodiversity Free Library, which is a library of books about neurodiversity that is going to be housed at the Center for Independent Living Toronto. And then it will travel from the Center for Independent Living Toronto around to different libraries, different community centers, and different places throughout the province, so that people can check out these books and learn more about neurodiversity.
Okay. Thank you, Anne.
Great. It was great talking to you. Thanks.